The expressed views of the guests on this podcast are theirs alone and not necessarily endorsed by the host, TWBC, or any associated sponsor. Conversations that are robust yet balanced, on point and to the point. You're listening to The Talk of Tournament Water Skiing. This is the TWBC podcast. And now, here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, greetings one and all, and welcome to this, the latest edition of the TWBC podcast. I am the aforementioned Tony Lightfoot, thanking you for your support once again. All right, then, this next interview, or rather episode of the TWBC podcast, took a little bit of a while to arrange with my subject, but taking into account what's happened over the last few days, it would seem to me that in a relative sense good things, or rather more dramatic things, come to those who wait. And with that in mind, I'm actually interviewing my good friend from Italy, the organizer of the San Gervasio Pro-Am, along with his good friends Claudio Bonatti and his father, and also of the recent Europe and Africa Water Ski Championships. I therefore introduce to you all Matteo Luzzeri. How are you doing?
Tony, I'm good, man. Thank you for having me. I'm glad we get to do this.
All right, then. Absolutely. Last few days, I'm guessing the word has kind of got out in the water ski community with the injuries you sustained. But tell us a little bit more about it and what the prognosis is for recovery from here on outwards.
Yeah, so we were all together at the European Championships last week, and I was in the men's slalom final, and I was somewhere towards the end of the final, and there were already big scores in front of us, including Brando Caruso, who started with a 4 at 10-2-5 off the dock, I think third skier off the dock. So you could sense the nerves and tension and motivation on the side of the lake, let's say, for us who were warming up. And I went in as aggressive as I could. I knew that I had to chase big scores. And I was running late at 10-7, pretty much out of two ball. And so I was chasing, and then I got into a five ball with a lot of heat, but I also had a little bit of a headwind. And I decided that I needed to turn right there and then in order to get a shot at running the pass. And I sank the ski probably as I would imagine as much as it could have sank before snapping. And I blew the tail. Now, right before I blew the tail, my front binding released and the back quite didn't. It was a strange fall. You've seen it. You were announcing. I was moving, I was having a lot of momentum forward, down course, let's say, but I had already committed to a strong turn. So when the tail blew, the ski both turned and kept moving forward. So I didn't really get my foot wasn't, let's say, the relationship between my body and my foot wasn't such that the back foot could release. And so for the second time in my career, I found myself with a ruptured Achilles.
Okay, so how sharp and how immediate was the pain from that type of injury?
It's strange. It's a very sharp and intense pain. And you actually hear the bang, right? Like, and I mean the sound of it. You hear it just snapping, like... The best I could give you is like a shot from a firearm, or like a whip, the sound of a whip. But I heard it right away. And because it's not the first time that it happens, I knew exactly what happened. And the problem was in the foot is the left foot and it's my back foot. And I was using a rubber Wiley. And to be honest, Tony, a very loose and large Wiley binding, so my last thought would have been to snap an Achilles in that one. But basically what happened is after I broke the Achilles, the the wraps of the Wiley were pushing inward. So actually, if you can think of the back of a rubber binding, they were going towards my toes, right? And that's why I was calling the boat to come back. And luckily, PJ Lager was in the boat. I asked him for some scissors, and we immediately cut the binding. And took a second to get the nimble foot out, but I knew right away that I had broken it.
Okay, so how long ago was it that you ruptured the Achilles tendon the first time around?
So it was end of September of 2014. So I had just started the PhD in Tallahassee, and I came back from a pro tournament at Jack's, actually skiing my PB there, and then first practice set at Lake 38, blew the tail on an offside. It was the front foot at that time. Stupidly, I had a non-releasable front binding, and there was no way. I mean, that one, I really played with fire and paid dues. This time, I had a very loose, soft, big rubber binding in the back.
Okay, so you probably didn't go too much into the prognosis from here on out, but I am glad that you brought up your PhD studies in Florida State, because that's going to go a long way to form in one of my next questions. But how long is it going to take? How long does it typically take for an Achilles rupture to heal to the point where you could actually go back out there and ski?
So, you know, when it happened 9 years ago, the first thing I did was to contact fellow skiers that had the same issue. And at the time, I knew Glenn Campbell had it, Karina Nolan had it. And I heard anywhere between 5 to 8 months, depending on a lot of factors, depending on type of surgery, whether it was the front or the back foot. But my surgeon at the time, 9 years ago, said anywhere between 3 to 6 months, which I know sounds very broad, but it did happen in October, so I had a whole off season to recuperate, and I took my first set shy of 6 months. This time, I don't know. We didn't speak at length with my surgeon here about coming back schedule, but I'm keeping 6 months as some type of guideline. Might be a little less, might be a little more, but we'll see. The one thing that worries me, Tony, is that it's my back foot, and
which takes a good portion of the pressure. I mean, coming off the turn,
and it's just much more extended, right? So the ski is never quite at 0 degrees; it's always tip up, tail down. So if you think about the position of your ankle in your back binding or toe loop, whatever you use, it's more bent. So that tendon is further stretched. And so I don't know. It might be 6, it might be 8. Who knows?
All right then. So let's do a little bit of a comparison between what you did and what was it 9 years ago and what you've recently gone through. Whenever you ruptured your Achilles tendon in the first instance, you were just about to go into your PhD studies on the sports psychology. Now you're 9 years later. You're a doctor. Matteo Lazzari, a doctor of sports psychology. With that kind of passage of time and with the acquired knowledge that you've gained during that program, kind of give us a sense of how you're going to approach recovery from this injury, but armed with the knowledge that you have now, compared to what you didn't have before nearly a decade ago.
See, this is a very good and multifaceted question, right? Because I do have a couple of advantages now. I have knowledge in Achilles injury, just because I've been through it, and I know roughly speaking the stages. And I also know a little bit about what is a healthy way to sustain, you know, recovery from an injury and eventually return to play, or in our case, return to ski. With this particular injury, the frustrating thing is that for 2 months, I can't do anything towards rehab, right? So you hear, as you know, in recent months, we have had quite a number of skiers, particularly female jumpers, going through ACL surgery. And that is a very long process, but current protocols basically dictate to be active within 2 weeks of surgery. 2 to 3 weeks, you're already doing something towards betterment of your condition. Whereas with the Achilles, I just have to stay put for 2 months, roughly speaking. So
because the Achilles is more weight-bearing compared to the ACL, right?
It's weight-bearing, and they basically... Mine was, again, a full rupture, so they had to insert one part of the tendon into the other and stitch it up. And so they need to make sure that that tissue starts to scar properly and heal properly before you work towards first lengthen it back to a normal length, and secondly, to eventually regain muscle in your calf, like in your lower leg. So as of right now, I had surgery on Tuesday. It went very well. Luckily, it's not too complicated of a surgery, so took about an hour. The tendon was in good shape, meaning it wasn't frayed from overuse, but it was snapped. So that brought a couple of advantages. They didn't have to take muscle tissue elsewhere in order to, let's say, thicken the Achilles tendon, which is a standard procedure, particularly from people that they have it breaking without a trauma, like as opposed to me. But they did use, this is pretty interesting, they used the longest tendon we have in our body is from the, I don't know how to say that in English, but it's a small muscle that we have in our calf that we don't really use. It's a bit of a inheritance from primates, and that muscle used to be used to curl your feet. And in fact, like 1 out of 10 people don't have it anymore, but it has a long, thin tendon that oftentimes is used to strengthen the Achilles suture in the case of a rupture. And so that's what they used for me. They used this particular tendon to strengthen the suture of the Achilles.
All right, and then. Okay, so going from the physical more to the mental aspect, which is basically your wheelhouse. You as I mentioned, you are a doctor of sports psychology. The prognosis is pretty much set in stone. It's going to be like about 8 months at the very least. So how is that going to weigh on your mind psychologically compared to your original injury, which you did 9 seasons ago?
Well, it's going to be tougher this time. Particularly, as I said, these first 2 months, you can't do anything towards betterment. And you're not very mobile. I mean, my foot is in a cast with toes pointing down, so I can't walk. I can't really sit properly to do even just, you know, a bit of like upper body or exercise. So the challenge right now in the next 2 months is going to be to keep myself busy mentally. As you know, I manage a ski school, so there's plenty of things outside of the boat that I can do, even from here. On Lake Iseo, I came to stay with my parents for the next short-term future in order to be assisted a bit. It's a little hard to cook and do other daily functions with this condition. But I think that, as I said, the first 2 months are going to be the hardest because let alone that I can't ski, it's hard to be in the boat with this. And I love coaching. But I will do my best to be at the lake and be around. And then, you know, the way I see it is, if it's 6 months, it's end of January. If it's 8 months, it's end of March. So considering a typical Northern Hemisphere season, it shouldn't be that big of a difference. The one important thing, I'll tell you this, the one important thing is that I want to be told, like I was told 9 years ago, that when the time comes, I can just ski. Meaning, you know, it'll take a number of sets before you regain physical strength, like skiing strength and skiing feeling, but without any worries about the tendon. That's what I look forward to. And until I hear those words from my surgeon, I'm not going to ski. I just want to be reassured that once I put my foot in a toe loop from now on, I'll be able to start doing what I love again.
Well, that's probably going to be one of the major obstacles to undergo, because obviously you had a rear Whitey's binding and both of your feet were basically locked down to a certain extent. Now you're going to have to go to the toe loop, which is favored by more of the skiing population, but it's a different type of skiing, you know, compared to skiing with both feet in.
For sure, for sure. The weird thing is, I've done it for the vast majority of my skiing career, and then for a number of reasons, basically testing different things for fluid motions in on my back foot, I sort of got stuck to a non-toe loop type of binding in the back, and that's what I've been using for the last 5 years. But my whole skiing career has been with a toe loop. And then in the winter of between 19 and 20, I did try to go back to a toe loop and I spent about 20 sets and I was struggling, but I was struggling performance wise, right? And like any other fellow skiers, I would imagine in my situation, I sort of said, the hell with it. I'll go back to my rubber boot. I've been skiing well with it. Why changing now? Now I have a strong reason to change. But I do believe that the toe loop is better. I think if you notice the frequency of people that don't have a toe loop in the back is diminishing. I mean, I recall very well in Monaco, they called all the eight of us that made the final up on or nearby the podium. And I was the only one without something in the back of, I was the only one out of the top eight with a binding in the back and not a toe loop. And I think that if you go down the list of skiers that don't use a toe loop in the back right now, it's a very short list. So there's also very sound technical reasons to do that change, but now it's also a risk diminishing factor.
All right then. So 8 months away from getting back out onto the water. So you'll be busy running ski school as you mentioned. I mean, it's obviously going to be frustrating for you. Working with the ski school, you probably won't get in the boat all that much, you know. So who will you have to basically pick up the shortfall compared to your lack of motion going forwards?
Well, that's the full staff at Jolly, as you know, is Gennady Guraglia, Claudio Benatti, our technical director, and then myself. With the current situation, we are trying to readjust the schedule of reservations and practices that have been booked from now until November, basically. I do feel that once I'm out of the cast, which should be either 4 or 5 weeks, then I'll be wearing what they call like a theropod or a walking boot, you know. And even though I might not be able to walk for another 2 or 3 weeks at the beginning, at least that thing can get wet and I'm much more protected, because it's basically like a walking boot with a lot of air and cushions around. So at that stage, I'll feel more comfortable in getting into the boat. And so from then on, I think we'll be fine. I think the main challenge is this month of August, which incidentally we're not super busy or as busy as usual. because a lot of our clientele is young European kids, and now they all have their nationals, the under 17 Europeans, which are next week. There's a lot of tournaments for kids around, so August is actually incidentally more manageable. And then I think in September I'll be able to bring my contribution in the boat as well. The one stage I remember from 9 years ago that it's a life changer in this recovery is once you can walk. Even though it's with the boot, you're sort of like a little bit more independent. It's a big change in how you carry yourself throughout the day. I don't know if you knew this, but I think you'll enjoy it. When it happened in Tallahassee 9 years ago, I had just moved there. So besides Keith Albritton at Lake 38 and a couple of other early acquaintances, I didn't know anyone really in the city yet. And so our good fellow friend Braden Lee moved from Zachary all the way to Tallahassee for 3 months to assist me. That was such a demonstration of kindness and friendship. And he sort of held me until I was somewhat independent, you know.
And he doesn't really talk about that an awful lot. I'm going to have a word with him because, I mean, I'm over at Bennett's right now. I'm less than 50 feet away from him, and he's working in the pro shop right now. So I'm going to have to ask him a little bit more than that. But kudos to him for stepping up and helping you out in that big old time of need.
Yeah, he really did. It's one of those friendship when I called him and told me what happened, he said, I'm in the car this afternoon and I'm moving there. Something that I don't know how many people would you know have the fortitude to do. It helps to have someone helping around when you can only stand on one leg.
Yeah, certainly certainly is option limiting so far as mobility is concerned. But we spent a good fair amount of this podcast on the subject of your injury, and I certainly wish you the best going forwards. But whenever I was trying to get set up with this interview, there were certain questions and certain subject matters that I was wanting to basically hit upon, and a lot of those were about the organization of the two major events that you're involved with this season. The ninth edition of the San Gervasio Pro-Am presented by Santos Dussault, and the Europe and Africa Water Ski Championships. But let's go on to the first one, because, I mean, it was the ninth edition. I mean, you're close to celebrating a decade of organizing these tournaments with the skiers and everything being very receptive, you know. So kind of give us an idea of what it's like and just how popular it is, because it's not just the pros, it's the AMs, the amateurs as well.
Yeah, no, it's the event that is the dearest to me. It's unquestionable. It's an event that I conceived 9 years ago in conjunction, you know, with my dad and Claudio, but it was really inspired by me living in the US and starting to ski a few of the pro events and then noticing that there was none in Europe. So I kind of cherry picked from my favorite events and decided, okay, I want to do head to head. I want to have amateurs. It really started from there. And at the time, there was nothing in Europe, and now look how Europe is looking on the pro scene. I mean, just even you guys spend on a regular basis almost a month traveling Europe to broadcast very good events that have been arising in the last few years. So to me, the event is fun. Amateurs love it. We do have the Junior Challenge since 2018, which is also very dear to me. Where we invite the top juniors in the world to ski in a head-to-head format. But I think deeply it's the effect that this tournament had on the pro scene in Europe, and you know, what could argue in the US as well. Like the revival of pro skiing in Europe, I think, inspired US and Canada as well. You know, I'll leave you with this comment. I won't name the skier because I don't want to single him out. But when we were in Caiafa last month, we were sitting on that couch area where the skiers would sort of like rest and get ready before skiing. And this particular skier, we were looking at the whole, you know, spectacle that was going on in Caiafa that you guys showed so well. And he said, "Are you proud of this?" And I'm like, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Well, without you having that idea in 2014, who knows if this celebration would be here today?" And it really hit home, you know. I think that's the meaning that the San Gervasio Pro-Am has for me deeply. And then, of course, you know, all the features that make the event what it is, the head-to-head, the night at Le Campagnole on Friday where we give the bibs and we gather everyone before the event. There's a lot of features to it, but deeply is the role that the tournament has had and arguably still has in the sport.
Okay, so that tournament took place in the second week in July, the second full week in July. You kind of swapped dates with a little bit with Caiaphas. I mean, Caiaphas actually took place the weekend after you last season. Which kind of brings upon the question. I mean, so far as being able to coordinate those dates and those tournaments, how much communication do you have with an event like Caiafa with George Hatzis to make sure that you get the right date and everything works out amicably between both of you, or indeed any other events that took place, such as Monaco or Botas or Lacanau?
Lots of communication, Tony, because obviously the great thing that everyone in Europe now wants to do pro events has the challenge of trying to coordinate and, for instance, avoid unnecessary clashes like we had last year. So especially last winter, primarily through the Water Ski Pro Tour, there was a lot of effort in trying to make sure that all the pieces would fall into place and skiers could ski all the tournaments they wanted without fearing of a conflict, right? The way it resolved this year was for us to push our tournament a little later, which freed an early weekend in July. And so we had that nice sequence of Monaco, Lacanau, Greece, and San Gervasio. So yeah, a lot of communication, and I foresee that happening again this winter, especially given that there are other organizers who are interested in doing cash prize events in Europe. I know that for a fact. So the more organizers can coordinate, the more successful their events are, the more skiers will attend because there's no conflict, and the whole thing keeps arising. Right, that's the goal.
Now, one of those tournaments that I mentioned was the Monaco one, which was the one that stood out for me a little bit in being it was like a midweek pro competition as compared to the other ones, which were spread across maybe a 2 or a 3 day weekend. Do you anticipate some tournaments taking that approach rather than having to battle other sites for a particular weekend in the season, which there aren't that many?
Yeah, I think so. I think what Greg Defon and Alexi Keseglu, the two young organizers of this new event, did was very smart. They basically got inspired a lot by the Swiss Pro Slalom format, so no amateurs. One-day event, 2 preliminary rounds plus 8 skier final, and you can knock that over in a day. And given that, you know, there was a tournament in Spain the weekend before, there was Lacanau the weekend after, it made a lot of sense to sandwich in a Wednesday pro tournament. I think if organizers don't have amateurs, should consider these type of midweek tournaments. They make a lot of sense. The reception from the skier was positive, and the scores were high. I mean, there were three skiers with 3 at 10 to 5 that didn't make the final. So, I mean, the level was high, no matter if it was a Wednesday or a Saturday, you know. I think for certain tournaments that format works. If you have amateurs, it's a little bit more complicated because obviously amateurs might be at work or at school during the week, but it is nevertheless an option.
All right, then. So going through some of the pro tournaments that we've seen over the course of summer, I mean, there've been some amazing scores, of which I was a witness to in the previous few weeks. I mean, like Ali Nicholson was skiing out of her mind, wasn't she? And even Kayafa and also taking the eventual win at San Gervasio. But obviously that stands out for me. But which one stand out for you?
Well, for me, obviously Ali taking the win at home, running 10.7 in Kayafa. Obviously, the 10-2-5s in a row in the first round in Kayafa stood out. But to me, I don't know. I just give you these two names, and I want to hear your reaction, because to me, these are the new challengers, and they are Dane Meckler and Brando Caruso. Like, these two skiers are the ones that, you know, if you take them top threes of, you know, Will, Nate, Freddy, and maybe this season even more specifically Nate and Freddie, those are the next in line to bother a lot. We saw Dane in Miami at the end of last year. We saw Brando in Spain before Monaco, and even what he did against Tigas at the Europeans. These two guys are going to run 10-2-5, and once they do, I think 4 is going to be a very, very frequent occurrence. And with 4... you still do well at tournaments.
Indeed. In your mind, Dane Meckler and Brando Caruso were the skiers that kind of stood out for you. And I mean, like Dane Meckler for me kind of already showed us that he was to be feared amongst the slalom skiers just two seasons ago at the World Championships, where he got into 9.75 meters for the first time. But Brando Caruso seems to have found a comfort zone in being able to be competitive against the very best in the world.
Yeah, you know, Brando. Again, memory can go back to 2017 Worlds in Paris when he was top seed into the final. I mean, Brando has been amazing for a long time, but I think you might have nailed it. The big difference is comfort in skiing against the best of the world, which really comes by going to tournaments, right? Like, to continue to go there and be on the dock with the best and the most experienced. And I don't know, something happened to Brando in the last 2 years where I just see him more geared in, more focused, more thirst, that there's a thirst and anger for wins and scores. And, you know, I think Brando had a switch of gears right around 2 years ago, and we see it. I mean, if you recall Travers Grand Prix last year, everyone remembers that runoff at 41 off between Freddie and Will, but right behind them was Brando with 4. You know, so Brando beat Nate at Botas in a head-to-head. Like, Brando and Dane are those guys that are going to be standing on that top of the podium very soon, and once they do, they're going to want even more.
Yeah, and a thing also, and it goes back to the comfort thing, that, I mean, like, Brando Caruso has for the last couple of seasons actually ventured outside of Europe and actually competed in the likes of the Travers Grand Prix and the Mastercraft Pro and those events that basically round off the tail end of the season, Miami Pro Slalom and another one. So being able not to... So giving yourself the ability not to be spooked in a right. change of environment is certainly what I see difference wise for Brando Caruso.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like As a European skier going to the US for a streak of tournaments for the first time, or vice versa, US-based skier coming to Europe, like, you don't know anyone, you don't know the judges, like, it's all new and unknown, right? So it takes a little bit of time to get used to ski in those novel environments without let them affecting you adversely, right? And certainly Brando has been getting more experience in that as of recent, and the scores clearly show. I mean, I know we're gonna get to Europeans, but that first 10-7 indeed in the first round off the dock after not skiing for an hour was just, I mean, breathtaking, you know, like perfect, literally perfect, how you want to run a 10.75. And he did it cold off the dock at a final at a Europeans after not skiing for an hour. So, unbelievable.
All right, then. Let's focus in on the next event that you organize, because, I mean, with the San Gervasio program, I mean, you've done it 9 times. You're about to do the 10th one in 2024. But when it comes down to nailing all of the titled, European titled events that have taken place at Jolly Ski, there's only 3 of them. 2007, the European under 21s, the World Championships, World Junior World Championships in 2010, and then this most recent of tournaments, the 2023 ENA European Championships. So one would get the sense that while you're pretty enthusiastic about hosting pro tournaments, the same cannot be said really typically for the titled events, and I'm sure that you've got a strong reason and justification not to up until this time.
Yeah, and I've said it publicly before. I don't believe the future of this sport is in titled institutional events, but it's in professional events and in a professional tour. So naturally, the beliefs I have and my partners have transpire into the type of events we try to organize. But the Europeans came about a couple of years ago, where in full COVID time, I met the mayor of San Gervasio at a gas station, James Caburri, and he basically told me that he planned to go for election again in 24, and he wanted a big event in 23 that he could easily get the community and the local press, you know, excited about. And so the title event presents that opportunity, because it's a championship, European championship, world championship, Italian championship. And so he asked me for a world championship, and I quite frankly told him that it wasn't within our possibilities. But I did say on spot, and all of this is happening as we're fueling up our cars, I did say, well, we could do a European championship. And he was very excited. He said, wow, that's great. And so we bid for the 2023 Open Europeans in 21. And I must say that the European Federation was a little struck by it, because they said, well, we don't even know who's doing them next year. Are you sure you want to put a bid for 23? And we said, yes, we want to do it in 23. And then, as you know, the backstory, eventually 22 was supposed to be in Ukraine. With the war, that was not feasible, and Recetto took them on. Recetto is the Italian national training site. And so we were a little fearful that the European Federation wouldn't allow the Europeans to be in Italy 2 years in a row. And then, to my happy surprise, in Recetto at the final banquet last year, the European president, Patrice Martin, announced that the 2023 Europeans were going to be in San Gervasio. So, unusual for us to do a European championship. But I must say that the feedback I received from team captains, skiers, judges has been positive. So it makes me think that we might have done a half okay job.
Okay. And Just trying to give us an overview of what differences that exist in organizing a tournament at this level compared to what you've ordinarily done with the San Gervasio Pro-Am, kind of reel off, like, I don't know, like a top five differences in organization and what has to happen to one and doesn't need to happen to the other type deal.
Yeah, of course. So I think the ones that are going to come to mind all fall into the category of uncontrollables. So basically, it's all stuff that, you know, it's written in the rules of the European Championship and how that type of tournament should occur that you just have to do, and they're not necessarily about the tournament itself. So, for instance, you have to have doping control on Sunday. You have to have an opening ceremony, and it has to happen the first day, at the end of the first day of preliminary competition. You have to have a closing banquet, and certain prize awards have to be done at the lake, some at the final banquet. All stuff that, you know, to be honest, it's fine, but are new constraints that I'm not used to, right? And so it was just a bit of organization. The bib, the way the bib looks, needs to be approved by the European Federation. I can't just tell the company that I normally use, hey, this is how I want it. Give me some feedback on design. Like, it had to add the number, the bib number had to be a certain size. I mean, these are all minor details that, however, you're not used to, and pile up to a point where, you know, they give you a bit of stress and you want to make sure that everything is in order. Those are the main differences. Like, there's an official practice and an unofficial practice. The official practice is just one ride per skier per event. It has to happen at a certain, you know, 2 days before the event. Like, it's all these things, and some of them are in the responsibility of the chief judge. And I was lucky enough that we had a great chief judge that, you know, knew this tournament inside out and could answer questions that weren't really my competency to ask. But it was just this Marianne Persons, exactly. So there was this odd feeling of, I'm the organizer, but a lot of it I can't organize myself, you know. But all in all, like, we got into the vibe of it, and I think that the tournament, I think the opening ceremony in town was well received. It was cool to see, you know, as we were walking into town, like, a lot of people cheering from the windows. There were some cool aspects that you're not going to get at a pro event. But yeah, there was this sense of what is within my control, namely, I would do it this way, but I can't because the rules or the etiquette or the tradition impose that it needs to be done that way, right? So that was the new challenge, let's say. But all in all, I think it was a good event. We saw good performances, and especially the skiers were happy with the way the ski event ran. That was my main thing. I wanted the skiing to be fair, with good conditions, good drivers, boats were new, like, all the skiing related things, ramp, you know, were dialed in, and the skiers felt that it was, you know, a fair lake where to perform to the best of their ability.
Okay, yes, and I mean, there were some good performances. I mean, in both tricks events, some performances that stood out for me, Vincenzo Marino. I mean, for crying out loud, I mean, gone into 10.25 meters for the first time in his career. Not one, but six or seven course records were produced almost seemingly one after the other in the men's jump event in the finals. Yeah. So I mean, if you ever needed proof as to how the event skied and how it was received, then you pretty much got your answer right there.
Yeah, I think so. Right, I think the skiers that decided to attend found a good place and good conditions. Even the uncontrollables, there was an excessive wind. It wasn't that it was raining or cold. Like there were good conditions to ski at a high level. And those who were there reported, at least to me, that they felt that the skiing was fair. Now, some skiers skied to their potential, some didn't, but that's tournament skiing, right? But Vincenzo, unbelievable. He had been chasing that 10-7. Although he's very young, I know he could run it the whole season. And finally he did at the prelims at the Europeans. It was good to see Luca almost getting the win. But then in men's jump, Luca Rockenwald, and then Louis Duplan just sealed the deal at the first jump. And then obviously the double runoff between Brando and Thomas to win the gold was spectacular. I was watching it on my phone as I was getting accepted into the emergency, but it was nevertheless pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, and I did actually mention as funny as you should say that Matteo is probably watching on his phone right now as he's been carted off to hospital, and you messaged back saying that yep that's right.
Yeah, I'm here watching. No, it was a good event. I would say, also the overall with Edo and Luca, Edo and Louis. I think it was a good European championship. And I hope, those who skied it, those who watched on site, and thanks to you guys, those who watched it from home, had a good time.
All right then. So should you drive in? After you have the ability to walk and drive, and everything has been restored, and you happen to come upon Mayor Scuburi coming up and said, "Okay, those are good championships. Now can we host the Worlds?" What would you be in a position to say?
Well. My first getaway from it would be that allegedly you now need two lakes to organize a world championships. You have to be a two-lake site, which we're not yet. As you well know, exactly, there are big plans to divide and extend our lake to have two skiable lakes. So I'll use that at first. But I must say, I spoke with my father a little bit, and we do have other title events in mind. I don't know which ones exactly or when, but as of right now, the World Championships is just too big of an ask, financially, organization wise. And also don't forget that we are a ski school and we need a business to run, and we have a loyal clientele of young, aspiring, good athletes that trust in us to be able to train. And I know that with a world championship, it would make it complicated for them. So that's not in the cards. I hope James is happy with it, at least for a little while. And we'll definitely prepare for the 10th edition of the Pro-Am, and who knows, maybe another title event down the line.
All right then. So I'm rounding off the questions that I kind of had planned to ask you a little bit, one thing that came to mind as you begin your convalescence a little bit and trying to get some mobility back and get the pain management under control with the ruptured Achilles tendon. I mean, around about this time last year, your father wasn't undergoing a similar kind of thing. Last season, he was lying in a hospital bed watching the San Gervasio Pro-Am, and just kind of hoping for some kind of miracle to get him not only walking again but also skiing again. Speak to that a little bit, and how grateful you are to have your father up and about where he wasn't this time last year.
Well, it's you know, we all got very scared last year. What he had, which is the Guillain-Barré syndrome, is such a rare condition that, you know, for a while we were all wobbling in the unknown. And then once it was known and we knew that the therapy was easy, that was a little easier on everyone, including Dad, but it took months and months of rehab, a couple of months in the hospital and three or four out of the hospital to be able to live a regular life, moving around, and eventually even do a bit of water skiing. It's so good, you know, like, especially this summer when Dad was at the International, which is our overall tournament in June, that although it's this year was its 18th edition, Dad started it under a different name a couple of years earlier, and it was a tournament for kids. And last year he missed it, and that was the one that really told me it hurt him to miss. You know, he said, "I've never missed one. Like, this is the one I created." And to see him there, and we had a lot of kids at that overall tournament this year. That was the one time where the whole trend this summer was, man, last year I was in the hospital. Last year I was on a wheelchair. Last year I just gotten out of the hospital. This whole trend that we had with him this summer. So it's very special. And as you know, I've interrupted my own podcast because I want to release an interview I did with him. And now that I'm obviously a little bit more, you know, computer bound, I hope to release it soon. But we do talk at length about what happened and how that affected him. And it will be a video one so that we can put subtitles, because as you well know, Dad doesn't speak a word of English. But it is special to have him back. I want to think he has gathered a bit more of an appreciation for the two main things in his life. So his own business and the ski school, you know, that him and Claudio founded. Now that he's fully back into the swing of things, it's a little bit harder to see that appreciation. It's a lot of like, you know, shouldn't be like this, and that shouldn't be like that, and Matteo, you should be taking care of this. Why haven't you done it yet? You know, it's back to the usual Fedele, but I do know that there's a deep appreciation for what he has created over the years, and for us to know that he's here, you know, enjoying it on his own feet, it's truly special.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I mean, when I saw him for the first time this season in San Gervasio, I gave him a big old bear hug, you know, and just almost, yeah. I was almost in tears. As a matter of fact, I'm still tearing up right now, even thinking about it. And I'm sure that's probably the case for a lot of other folks that reacquaint themselves with Fedele. And we certainly congratulate him on making his recovery and getting back out there on the water and skiing to not the highest level that he's probably used to. But you know, I mean, it. You know, as they say, Rome was a built in a day type deal.
Definitely. And you know, you make me reflect on how inspiring it was to see him in the hospital during rehab and all the goals that he set to himself, both in the hospital and out. So you know, when you asked me a few minutes ago what type of mindset I foresee having, or I should have, well, on top of what I've learned having broken my Achilles before, and on top of what I know being a mentally healthy way of going through this, just thinking back of how Dad did it last year is also a big motivation and a big source of inspiration.
All right, so as we move towards the end of this podcast, it's almost been an hour talking and chatting away. But one thing I forgot to touch upon, and I know you're heavily into and Slansky and Claudio Bonatti heavily into the other events overall and all that kind of thing. And that which brings me to this subject. You know, Slalomin is certainly getting up. Certainly getting up there for recognition within pro skiing. It's always going to be there. Tricks and jump, not nearly as much. But what I have personally tried to do, and you probably know this already, is to put a special emphasis upon overall, because, I mean, that represents, in my mind, a collection of the sport's very best skiers, not only being able to do it in one event, but also being able to do it almost equally well, if not better, in the remaining two. And I've tried to equip myself in the announcing booth with my little touch screen and everything, and the spreadsheets and what have you, to try and give instant update on the results. But do you feel that the overall still has a viable place within the sport at this level?
So the short answer is no, but I think the best example that I can think of is track, right? To be a decathlete, we would all agree that the best athletes in track and field are the decathletes. Like, they can do everything. And that argument is even stronger in water skiing, because you think of someone like Joel or Dorian or Janina or Regina, and you're like, well, they're also among the best in the world in some of those individual events. But I feel that as of right now, the pyramid of overall skiers is so small, meaning that you know, we lose so many at the mid level, whether it's because you go to university and you don't have time to stay at the lake the whole day, or you start getting into a career, a job, and you can't stay at the lake the whole day. And I feel that, you know, sadly the conditions are not there to see a lot of overall competition. But then also you have the striking fact that we are now seeing the highest level of overall we've ever seen, and probably even we never imagined to have such complete across the three events and so good overall skiers. So I think, sadly, the conditions for someone to excel, or sorry, for a group of people to excel in overall are not there. But there are a very selected few that are doing unbelievable things. So I don't know. It's a complicated question. I see high level in overall skiing these days, both in the men and women's side. I see a lot of overall skiing in the youth categories. But I know that we keep losing more and more, somewhere between U17 and Open, and I don't know if anything can be done at the current stage about that.
All right, then. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. Thanks a lot to you, Matteo Lazzari. Thank you for the for sparing me the time to conduct this interview. I know you're busy and you've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies and you know, and you're trying to convalesce from the injury. And we'll certainly wish you the very best over the next few months as you get back to somewhat of somewhat mobile status. But part ways and conclude this podcast, anything you'd like to say?
Yes. Thank you, Tony, first of all. I mean, it was a pleasure to spend some time chatting with you. There is one person that I want to thank that you know very well, and maybe the broader skiing community doesn't know well yet. But she is the one that has been allowing a lot of the events to happen and, to be honest, allowed them to be beautiful. I think that's the best adjective, like looking good, proper, professional, both on the side of things, on the graphics, and that's Michaela, that's my sister. She has been collaborating with us for 4 years now, but incidentally, her passion for skiing, which is a new thing for her, she just started really skiing 3 years ago, also made her game step up on the organization side. And for all those of you who have come to ski our events this year, last year, who have watched them on the webcast, who follow us online, a lot of it is the credit should go to Michaela. So I just wanted to say that publicly and thank her a lot.
All right, then. And that has been the latest episode of the TWBC podcast, thanking Matteo Lazzari for his participation. And until the next episode, it is ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC podcast.